from Stettin in the Baltic to Trieste in the Adriatic, an iron curtain has descended across the continent.
It's time to dust off those old copies of the Long Telegram and the Mr. X article because George Kennan is back in vogue. From Ukraine to Syria, Russia's aggressive international posture over the past couple of years have led a number of Kremlin watchers and policy analysts to call for a revival of the Cold War policy of containment. It does have a certain allure, but Vladimir Putin's Russia is not the Soviet Union, and the globalized world of 2015 is a far cry from 1947. Can the West contain a Russia that is determined to upend the international order, but which at the same time is deeply ingrained in the global economy? Hello from our broadcast headquarters in Prague, and welcome to the Power Vertical Podcast. My name is Brian Whitmore, author of the Power Vertical blog here at RFERL. Joining me on the Skype line from Oxford, England, is James Scher, an associate fellow with and former head of Chatham House's Russia and Eurasian program. Welcome back to the podcast, James.
Thank you, Brian.
And also joining us via Skype from Newton, Massachusetts, is Daniel Dresner, a professor of international politics at the Fletcher School of Law and Diplomacy at Tufts University, a senior fellow at the Brookings Institution, and author of the book Theories of International Politics and Zombies, and the recently published The System Worked, How the World Stopped Another Great Depression. Welcome back, Dan.
Thanks, Brian. Good to be here.
Good to have you. Good to have you both. Well, writing in Foreign Affairs last November, Rutgers University Newark professor Alexander Motyl wrote that it's time for the West to, quote, develop a serious, steady, long-term policy response to Russian expansionism, and that, of course, means containment. In an article in Slate around the same time, James Goldgeier, dean of the School of International Service at American University, likewise wrote that, quote, a revived strategy of containment is necessary to counter Russian aggression. Soviet defector Alexander Goldfarb, head of the Litvinenko Foundation in London, made a similar argument just last month. And in remarks this week, U.S. Defense Secretary Ashton Carter said Washington would, quote, will take all necessary steps to deter Russia's malign and destabilizing influence, coercion, and aggression. James, let's start with you. I mean, is containment relevant today? Is, and of course, I'm paraphrasing Kennan now, Russian pressure against the free institutions of the Western world something that can be contained by the adroit and vigilant application of counterforce at a series of constantly shifting geographical and political points corresponding to the shifts and maneuvers of Russian policy? I've dusted off my copy of the Mr. X article too, as you can see. But is this relevant today, James?
Let's understand something. The challenges we face from Russia today would be every bit as serious as they are, even if the Cold War had never existed. So I would suggest putting that parallel out of our minds. I think what we need is not a revival of the old Cold War policy of containment, but a new policy of containment that fits present circumstances. And I think it would have to contain three components. On the military side, one issue that needs to be addressed is a major gap in the West's overall defenses, of course, in particular the United States. The Russians today regard a theater nuclear weapon in a local and regional conflict as a tool of de-escalation. The reason they are beginning, and have for some years, been writing and thinking about the feasibility of limited nuclear war is in large part because the West has entirely eliminated that level of capability. So this is a temptation that they have that we need to address in the context of an overall defense review, which I think President Obama needs to announce, and he needs to explain the rationale for it. The second part of it is economic, and it relates to the sanctions issue. The part of the sanctions which is extremely relevant here is the part that restricts export of dual-use technology. The Russian defense complex today is at one level or another dependent on Western components for as many as 800 different weapon systems. This is a constraint that we need. It should not be linked to the resolution of the Ukraine crisis. And the last point I would make just in this introductory part of things is I think we need to change our behavior as much as our policy. When we are clearly being tested, when Turkish airspace, NATO airspace is violated, not once but twice, we can't be sitting back taking notes. We have to defend our airspace. We have to show the Russians that when they move around the board, somebody is there. We have been pursuing a policy or an absence of a policy that suggests that that we are really deterring ourselves. When the Russians unilaterally move a demarcation line in Georgia, and in the process incorporate a kilometer of the Baku-Supsa pipeline, there have to be changes in our defense profile in Georgia. When a U.S. Secretary of State is kept waiting for 3 hours by the Russian president, he should not be thanking him for his generous hospitality at a press conference. I mean, these are our behavior and the tonalities of our behavior, which Russians take very seriously, has to change. And that can be done fairly swiftly.
Dan, your thoughts?
I'd say a few things. The first, just to sort of in some ways reiterate what James said, this is not 1948. As easy as it is to sort of bring back the containment analogy, there's so many ways in which the current Russian problem is not the same as the one that posed that started to emerge during the Cold War, that I think bringing up the analogy can be a little bit dangerous. The most important distinction is that Vladimir Putin's Russia today is far less powerful and potentially powerful than the Soviet Union circa 1948 was, for a whole variety of reasons, including command of allies, military, and what seemed at least at that point like an economic development model that had potentially some plausibility. I would also offer sort of three points that I would make in terms of how you're supposed to deal with a Russia now. That really is – that quote you read from Kennan is interesting, though, because it does suggest there's so many different points at which Russia seems to want to apply pressure at this point. The first is just simply you want to remind Vladimir Putin that the security dilemma exists, that every time Russia takes some sort of action that it views as totally legitimate, it leads to a balancing coalition. So this can range from, strengthening, let's say, the coalition to combat ISIS in Syria and making sure the Turkish airspace is protected if Russia decides it wants to go there, to, I think, far more significantly, encouraging, let's say, Sweden to join NATO, because I think that actually would be one of those moments that would potentially cause the Russians to
start Finland, thinking. For that matter.
Well, right, but I assume Sweden is first. First of all, because public opinion is more receptive to the idea, and second, if you get Sweden to join NATO, then suddenly Finland probably might look at its own choices a bit differently. Second, you want to set up economic structures that basically. I would argue, in that sense, you want some sort of selective containment. You don't want to cut Russia out of the global economy completely for a variety of reasons, one of which is I don't think it'll work, and another is that I think that's a surefire way of creating a split between the United States and Europe. But that said, you do want to negotiate things like TTIP, because that is a sort of modern integration agreement that doesn't necessarily include Russia and nonetheless sort of cements the power of the West. And I think the third and most important thing is that if you're really concerned long-term about what Russia is going to look like, you have to double down on investments in energy alternatives, because in some ways that's Russia's Achilles heel. You have to think of the Russian economy at this point as basically an overgrown version of Kuwait, and anything that keeps energy prices down constrains Russian power significantly, both in the form of blocking, Western, basically export revenue from entering the Russian economy, and also weaning Europe of the need to of its perceived dependence and actual dependence on Russian energy. And so the fewer options or the fewer people that are clamoring for Russian energy over the long term, the less power Russia is going to have.
I would agree with the military steps that you've both suggested, but I actually think the military part of this, even though we haven't done it yet, is the easy part. Because the trick of this, and I agree, is that's why I said in the intro, this is not 1947 or 1948, and any kind of containment that we do now is going to have to look a lot different than the containment that we had during the Cold War. But the hard part is, unlike that then, when you had two hermetically sealed systems, you have a Russia that is fully integrated into the world economy and, as I argue on my blog yesterday and on the Daily Vertical today, has essentially weaponized globalization. It's weaponized globalization through hacker attacks, through using hot money in the city of London, shell companies throughout Europe, financing of extremist parties in Europe. They're attacking on a lot of fronts that are not military fronts. And how do you counter that, James?
But you see, you've just highlighted a major Russian weakness.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Russia's exports over the past year, from August to August, have declined 39%. Now, about half of that is the ruble write-down. Mm-hmm. But despite this, Europe is Russia's first trading partner. Germany trades more with Poland than it trades with Russia. This is an illustration of the fact that although Putin is playing a weak hand to the full and is using limited power to the full, at the strategic level, there's a lack of wisdom there, and so this is an issue that should, and I suspect is, deeply worrying Russians. It can worry us. We can afford to be considerably less worried by it.
No, I had an interesting conversation in Brussels about a couple of weeks ago with a European defense official, and it was an argument about whether the West should arm Ukraine. And I think this illustrates your point nicely, James. And he was arguing against this, and I was kind of surprised, a military man arguing against this. But he said it doesn't make any sense because on that field, Russia always will have escalation dominance. They're going to be willing and able to escalate to a higher level than we are. We should fight where we have escalation dominance. And I said, where is that? And he said, it's obvious. It's the SWIFT ban. And he pointed this out by saying when Dmitry Medvedev went on television and said if the West imposes a SWIFT ban, Russia will see this as an act of war. And he said, my response was, thank you, Mr. Prime Minister, for revealing your biggest weakness. Isn't this a place where the West really could cut Russia's legs right out from under them? But yet we'd be unwilling to do it because it might be too costly for us, because the Europeans wouldn't like it, because it's going to cost a lot of people money in the city of London or in the London property market, or it's going to cost German energy companies money or what have you. Isn't this it gives them a bit of an asymmetrical advantage? Well, at the same time, it's their biggest weakness. No,
I just had a footnote on Ukraine. I think Russia's military card in Ukraine is vastly overrated, Brian. I mean, consider the fact that after all of this and two major offensives, their separatist proxies control 5% of Ukrainian territory. I think, you know, there are things that we need to do to help Ukraine in the defense area, including some weapons that will further stabilize the situation and add to the deterrence that's already there. So it's a different issue. Mm. Now, let me yield to Dan when it comes to the issue you raised about SWIFT, which is very controversial in its own right.
Yeah, I have to say I would probably be opposed to the idea of cutting Russia off from SWIFT from a couple of reasons. But in some ways, I would push back on your underlying premise, which is that somehow Russia has an asymmetric advantage from its participant, you know, from weaponizing globalization. I think that overlooks the degree to which the United States has actually excelled at weaponizing globalization. And you can see that in terms of the effect that the economic sanctions have had on the Russian economy. As much as Russia has been willing to try to, you know, game the system, I don't deny that doesn't happen. The truth is Russia needs the rest of the world a hell of a lot more than the rest of the world needs Russia. And the United States has been relatively adroit at putting together a sanctions regime that really has – you know, caused it's a significant factor in Russia's economy contracting in 2014 and now 2015. And I think the problem if you cut Russia off from SWIFT is twofold. The first is, as you say, you know, the Russians are going to interpret that in a negative way, would be the understatement of the decade. you know, but the more important question is the more important question is that if you cut Russia off, it's not so much the effect on Russia, it's the effect that other potential, let's say, members of the BRICS view that act, which is to say they might start asking themselves, well, if the United States is going to cut Russia off from SWIFT, what's to stop them from doing the same for us? And so you might see the creation of a sort of parallel finance and, you know, payments and finance system. It's worth remembering, for example, the creation of the euro markets during the Cold War. The trigger for that was the fact that the Russians knew, the Soviets knew they couldn't open up bank accounts in the United States. So they actually created these, you know, the London, the city in London created these parallel financial markets, which allowed the Soviets to hold dollars not in the United States. So I think I would be very wary of cutting the Russians off from SWIFT.
Well, I look. Oh, go ahead, James. Go ahead.
The fundamental point is that we should not be implementing measures that hurt us more than they hurt the Russians. And this is, you know, this is a problem with SWIFT and with many other variants for raising the level of sanctions. The sanctions currently in place, and particularly the ones relating to technology that hurt the modernization of Russia's armed forces and its energy sector, those sanctions over time will have and are already having a very serious impact. And if we're interested in containment, what we're interested in doing is diminishing capability over time, not looking for a quick fix that will change behavior over the next couple of weeks.
So you would argue that the sanctions then, I assume, should become a permanent part of the landscape, should not be, as you said, not tied to Ukraine, but tied to what?
Some of them should be. And I would make a Cold War parallel here. We had COCOM.
I'm glad somebody raised COCOM. I wanted to raise COCOM.
Technologies that are important to the military sector should be restricted as a matter of policy. The consequence, negative consequences of this on our side are not very significant. It's the other stuff people talk about that's more damaging to economies in Europe. We don't need to go there.
Dan, on the SWIFT ban, I just had a side question. Can the U.S. do that unilaterally, or how is that done, if that is done?
I don't want to get too much into
I'm not fully versed
in the technical nature of it. The reason the U.S. it can't exactly do it unilaterally, but the U.S. combined with Europe, if the U.S. and the EU said we no longer want to deal with Russian money for whatever reason. I mean, in some ways, for example, SWIFT banned the Iranian central bank from the SWIFT network. It did so because logically it concluded that there was no point in including them because both the European Union and the United States had cut Iran off. Mm-hmm. And since those two entities, you know, represent the bulk of global finance and this sort of almost every major financial center in the world, SWIFT sort of said, OK, we see where this is going. We're just going to cut them off. If the Europeans were to resist, let's say, a SWIFT ban on Russia, I don't think SWIFT would take a similar action there. But the point is, SWIFT, there is a degree of independence between SWIFT and the United States. But the United States has such overwhelming financial hegemony that the two are clearly related.
One other footnote. I mean, it's not a matter of speculation. Berlin and Washington have firmly agreed that if there is another escalation in Ukraine, there will be an order of magnitude escalation of sanctions. And this message has been communicated in unmistakable terms to the Kremlin. And I think it plays a role in the fact that now there is at least a moment of quiet. A moment of quiet there. So this has been discussed, and there is U.S.-European unity on this. And it's very important we keep it.
I would agree that I think in some ways the best use of that possible lever is an act of deterrence.
Exactly.
Rather than
I was going to describe it as the nuke. I mean, the SWIFT ban is the nuke of this containment. You don't you it's in reserve. Yeah. You have to be ready to use it, but you're not going to use it.
And there are other and there are other things, but quite right. Yeah.
Right, but the other thing I would say, by the way, is that I mean the fact that the matter that the situation in Ukraine has died down to the point where it actually looks like the Minsk agreements might, you know, even God forbid, be implemented, is telling because it also I think it shows to some degree the limits of Russian power, which is it can try to escalate in Ukraine, it can try to escalate in Syria. I don't think it actually can do both. I don't think it has the capabilities to do both.
What is astonishing here, and it's the subtext, is that we are being consistently outmaneuvered and surprised by a country which, by comparison with the Soviet Union and by comparison with ourselves, is almost definable by limits in power. And that points to a very systemic problem, a deeply systemic defect we have that needs to be addressed, which is an old hobby horse of mine. It's a deep deficiency of expertise, but also in our bureaucracies and our political elites, an enormous deficit of people who understand what it means to think strategically and connect the dots. Putin is doing that. Sorry, push back.
I want to push back a little bit on that. It's not that I completely disagree. I think you're right. I mean, you know, particularly in the United States, there's been over the last year an observation that, in fact, the federal government has lacked a sufficient amount of expertise on Russia. But in terms of the strategic thinking part of that, I think one of the reasons that Vladimir Putin has flummoxed the West is that he's taken some actions that strategically don't make that much sense. And so, therefore, in some ways, the West had ruled out the notion that Putin would go down that part of the decision tree. And I think the intervention in Syria is one example of that, which is to say it's easy to say right now, oh, my God, look at what Putin has done. You know, he's rapidly moved Russian forces into Syria. There's this combined offensive, you know, involving Hezbollah, Iran, Russian air power and Assad's military. Look at how quickly they're going to do all this stuff, except two important points here. First, great power military interventions like this always look their most threatening at the first moment they announce it, and then they get bogged down. And every piece of evidence I've read on Syria suggests they are going to get bogged down, and this is not going to work out nearly as well as Putin had thought. And second, and related, this is not going to be a popular intervention in Russia. You know, the Russian propaganda machine, I greatly respect their capabilities of trying to valorize this, but this is not like going into the Russian parts of Ukraine. You know, there was a sympathetic audience in Russia for that kind of move. I don't think there is any love in Russia for the idea of they have to somehow, you know, expend Russian blood and treasure for Bashar Assad.
Well, the way they're framing it and the way they're spinning it is we're fighting the terrorists there so we don't have to fight them here. That's the way they're spinning it. They're saving Assad. They're spinning
right,
it.
Right. But that, I mean, that, so in other words, they're articulating a draining the swamp analogy.
Yes.
10 years after the United States tried to, you know, the Bush administration tried to use that analogy. And my hunch is it'll work about as well as the Bush administration's rhetoric did, which is it'll buy them a short period of time. The problem is they're not actually going to win. They're not actually going to. I mean, you know, the evidence I've seen of the sort of first massive offensive actually suggests they've achieved only minimal gains. And unlike the United States, I don't think Russia could surge even more materially because we're starting to hit the really hard constraints on Russian power.
The issue is not whether they win. The issue is how much damage they do to others. And you just look at the whole refugee business and understand this. Vladimir Putin is the master of lose-lose outcomes. He's turned the security dilemma upside down, which is to say that his way of answering Russia's security problems is to actually magnify Russia's security problems, not just somebody else's. But I am bothered by the fact I come back to the point that we are continually being surprised in ways we wouldn't if we understood their mode of thinking. And not everyone has been surprised. I'm not going to mention names, but there are, you know, a number of experts who have warned people to expect certain things that have occurred and were pretty much dismissed out of hand. The problem is that our templates of strategic thinking are very Western, and they don't take into account the completely different optic and framework within which the Russians think and act.
Go ahead.
Well, I say I don't necessarily disagree. I think you're right. As I said, these actions have legitimately surprised a lot of Western policymakers. The interesting question going forward is whether in some ways, the Western expectation that this is just going to be another morass for Syria turns out to be true, and then what that means for Russia. Because there are ways in which, you know, you occasionally hear these rumblings about, you know, what's the only thing worse than Vladimir Putin? It's who would replace Putin if there was, in fact, a putsch or something like that. And so I do think in some ways that there needs to be more serious gaming out in the West of what happens in Russia if, in fact, Putin's strategic power plays don't work out terribly well.
What about that, James? I mean, is the goal here regime change, or is the goal here something else? It's a changing of Russian policy.
Regime change, first of all, is none of our business, and secondly, it's nothing we know how to do. Our responsibility is to protect our allies and our partners and let Russia work itself out. My prediction is that if Vladimir Putin goes, whoever replaces him will find that he has inherited quite a mess and a set of realities that are far worse than appearances currently suggest. But by doing what he's doing, he understands one thing, that the West is led by governments that are not high-risk players, that we are shy even about using our own strengths, and that this all contributes to the image they are trying to create, which has a lot of resonance in our political systems, that you have to deal with Russia whether you like it or not. You have to bring them on board whether you trust them or not. You have to make concessions and compromises to them, even if you think they're unwise. Well, from that point of view, I think they're doing very well because they've judged us far better than we've judged them.
So we've seen the enemy and it is us. I wanted to pick up on something James was talking about COCOM earlier and actually throw this to Dan because you're the expert in international economics. Russia's a member of the World Trade Organization. Can you do things like COCOM restrictions on a member of the WTO?
Yes.
How?
Because there's a national security exemption within the WTO. So you can always restrict trade because of concerns about national security.
And you can always invoke that unilaterally?
Well, there are limits to the extent to which you can invoke. I mean, you know, there has to be an obvious sort of connection between the two. But, I mean, COCOM and GATT coexisted quite well.
Except Russia except the Soviet Union wasn't a member of GATT.
That is true. But that said,
this is the thing I was wondering about when I was thinking this through and writing this up on the blog. What can be done within the confines of the WTO? And if
right, but the answer is there is a national security exemption within the WTO, so it would not be that hard to basically revive COCOM or some variant of COCOM. I think the restriction would be that it would have to be on the restriction would be, and this was always a running debate within COCOM, was what was the range of technologies that were legitimate to restrict exports to the Soviet Union. And this was always a case where the United States always wanted to have the most expansive definition of what dual-use technologies were, whereas the Europeans were like, well, wait a minute, let's just keep this to what are obviously technologies that have military applications. And the only way you would be able to revive it would probably be to have to go the latter route, because otherwise the same dynamic would play itself out now. And if the Europeans would very much not, you know, want to have too expansive of an export embargo.
James, what do you think it would take to change the equation in terms of the political will here? Because I think you're right. We've been kind of I don't want to, I guess, lulled into a sense of complacency by the 90s, by the immediate post-Cold War period. We were clinging to this hope that the more Russia became integrated into the international community and in the world economy, they'd begin to play by its rules and become a more responsible actor. And what's it going to take to shock us out of this if what has already happened hasn't been enough?
I think that when the realities sink in that we understand the means at our disposal, and that we understand our own interests, and we are not going to make concessions for the sake of making concessions, and we are going to apply cumulative pressure against them in an intelligent way, I think over time calculations will change that.
But what about here? I mean, how close are we to coming to that?
I think we're very far away from it, because we are still disconnecting issues that need to be looked at in an integrated way. There's still a lack of understanding of who we are dealing with. This whole argument you have between so-called engagers and people who don't believe in engaging is so wildly beside the point. There's every reason to talk to the Russians, but only when you have something to say, not for the sake of talk. Mm. And when our first response to anything outrageous they do is not to respond, but to pick up the telephone, it sends a message that's very harmful to our image and our interests.
All right. Before we wind up the first half and move into the second, I'd like to kind of summarize. I mean, what are the components of this, if there is going to be a modernized 2015 version of containment that recognizes this isn't 1947? What are the components, James? You outlined some of them there in terms of the military closing some of the gaps militarily, which we seem to be moving toward in some areas. I mean, the NATO summit in Wales, I thought, was a quantum leap, actually, in the right direction in terms of setting up those tripwires in the Baltic states and on the states in NATO's eastern frontier. Keeping the sanctions as almost a permanent part of the landscape until Russia's behavior changes another. And the third is a change in attitude in the West itself, right? Would you add anything or modify any of those?
Well, as the opening of your program demonstrated, and if you go back to that situation, in order to turn... to change the frame of reference of the West, there needed to be the presentation of the realities and the challenges from the highest level in the most compelling terms to elites and national publics. This was much more difficult than people imagine now. A lot of people suppose we just slid into the containment policy almost naturally and inevitably. It was not like that. It was a near-run thing, and I do not see that kind of leadership in the West for doing this now on any major issue. We're not here to discuss it, but I'm constantly taken aback by discussions about China in Europe, which are either about strengthening economic commercial links or being tougher on human rights, without any mention of what the geopolitical challenges that China is posing in the Pacific. I mean, this is another example of a failure by leaders to articulate the problem to the publics, which in the end have to support tougher, more difficult, and more expensive policies.
So
that's
missing. So we need a Churchill or a Truman or something analogous.
You just need people who are good.
Dan, your thoughts?
People who are good would be good. I would say the other difference between now and the late 40s is also that there's a different kind of – the relationship between the United States and Europe is different. You know, if you take a look at the history of containment, the U.S. was able to use its hegemonic position in a pretty influential way to set up the initial COCOM. And as Europe got stronger, there were more internal battles within COCOM. But there's no doubt that U.S. hegemony played a significant role in the original creation. Nowadays, if you're going to do this, you would, the European Union, despite all of its travails, is a much more powerful actor than the sort of collection of European states were in the late 40s. And the only way you would be able to do this kind of thing is if you get buy-in from Angela Merkel at this point. Mm. I suppose one of the virtues right now of the sort of last couple of years is that if Angela Merkel is on board, then you've pretty much got the European Union. Merkel has answered Kissinger's question of, if you want to talk to Europe, who do you get on the phone? So I do think that does make it a little potentially more viable. And if what you say is correct in terms of there is an agreement between the U.S. and Germany on what the tripwires are of Russian activity that would trigger an even greater ratcheting up of the sanctions, then that's promising, because the way you maintain long-term sort of strategic embargoes or any kind of economic containment policy is you have to institutionalize it. It can't just be an ad hoc creation. Ad hoc coalitions inevitably fall apart because of fears of backsliding. So at some point, if this behavior continues, you are actually going to have to create a new COCOM.
Angela Merkel is the only leader we have at this point. But somebody has to explain to people that if we give Ukraine sovereignty away through a sleight of hand called federalization or implementation of Minsk, what the consequences are going to be, deep divisions and the ultimate fraying of ties and breakup of NATO, and will add to the pressures breaking up the EU. These dots have to be connected for our MPs, for newspaper editors, for public at large. And that is there's a key element of doing something like this. The stakes have to be laid out.
In a few moments, we'll continue our discussion and look at how Russia has used corruption as a tool of statecraft and weaponized finance to infiltrate Western institutions. I'd like to remind you, you're listening to the Power Vertical podcast. My name is Brian Whitmore, author of the Power Vertical blog here at RFRL. Joining me on the Skype line from Oxford, England is James Scher, an associate fellow with and former head of Chatham House's Russia and Eurasia program. And also joining us via Skype from Newton, Massachusetts, is Daniel Dresner, a professor of international politics at the Fletcher School of Law and Diplomacy at Tufts University, a senior fellow at the Brookings Institution, and author of the books Theories of International Politics and Zombies, and the recently published The System Worked, How the World Stopped Another Great Depression. I'd also like to remind you could subscribe to the Power Vertical podcast on iTunes, you can read the Power Vertical blog at rfrl.org, and you can follow us on the Twitter at Power Vertical.
Коррупция в высших эшелонах власти.
Побережье. Канны, Ницца, Монте-Карло.
200 миллионов долларов.
Пачка денег, коллекция часов из западных...
Все уходили в офшоры. В России офшорная аристократия. Ну, в принципе...
From shady energy deals to webs of shell companies to hot money in the city of London to the financing of extremist parties in Europe, the Kremlin has effectively weaponized globalization. Unlike the Cold War, when the world was divided into two hermetically sealed systems, today's conflict between Moscow and the West comes with Russia firmly embedded in the global economy, and this raises the economic costs and gives Moscow a ready-made lobby in Western capitals. Dan, we can argue over whether this gives them an asymmetrical advantage or a weakness, but isn't part of the problem here that the West is avid consumers of Russian corruption? I mean, have we become addicted to Russian money in the age of globalization? Because every time you talk about ratcheting up the sanctions, you get howls in the city of London. You get howls from the German industrial lobby. And there is, as I think, a ready-made constituency against these kind of measures that in order to contain this, we're going to have to take a good look at ourselves first, no?
I mean, I think on the one hand, that's true. But on the other hand, things have changed in the last year. I mean, if you take German industrialists, for example, I think your depiction of how they acted is accurate right up until the moment they shot down the Malaysian airline. Mm. And, you know, everything I've heard from people I talked to in Germany says that actually was a sort of, you know, epiphany moment for a lot of the sort of German industrial lobby that previously had been pushing for, like, restraint with respect to Russia, that at that moment they began to realize, okay, this is not something that's going to go away, particularly the Russian denials and so on and so forth.
I was wondering if that was an epiphany or if it was a temporary epiphany, because I'm starting to see noises coming from places like Germany and the city about this. I wonder about that.
I look at it this way. I think it partially depends on how Russia acts in Ukraine. If you see... You know, if you see the status quo persisting, which is the notion that the Ukrainians don't feel a mortal threat, that the rebel groups, you know, adhere to whatever the Minsk agreements and so on and so forth, then you could see something of a revival. But the way to think about it is as follows: each passing day that these people don't trade with the Russians is a day where they start looking for alternative markets. Mm. So, you know, it's not that I agree with you that there is some, obviously, there's always going to be a latent desire to expand trade with Russia because it's potentially an untapped market. But the longer the sanctions are in place, the more that this becomes the new normal. And so I don't think I'm as concerned as you are about the notion that the Russians have, you know, co-opted domestic lobbies in these countries to agitate for an end to the embargo.
James, what do you think? Have we collectively become addicted to Russian money in this age?
Interesting. I'm partially agreeing with Dan, and I wasn't expecting to. I think this problem was far more severe a few years ago than it is now. And let me just mention two reasons. The first is we are in the midst of a global energy revolution, which again highlights Russia's strategic limitations because they really didn't anticipate it. And one consequence of this is in this vitally important sector, there's less Russian money to go around than there was. Mm. The sector is highly indebted, by the way, in Russia. And the trends are very discouraging, overwhelmingly, for Russia. And China is not helping them very much. That's another big myth that they have created. The Chinese are the wisest and most self-interested people on Earth. And the Russians are, discovering this. The second related thing is the EU has put together the third energy package, which is really lethally effective at curbing a lot of these practices in energy. And energy is important because it's been the spin-off for all sorts of other Russian business activities that operate in the same way. We're becoming much wiser to this. Our internal defenses are growing. We still have a big problem. It's nothing to be complacent about. But I think the fact that we have, through a variety of measures, been defending ourselves has contributed to Vladimir Putin lurching out in this direction and from 2014 frontally attacking the rules of the system, which for 20 years Russia was only playing with, and suddenly now basically going to war with the rules because they are now proving they have finally been proving effective.
Now, I certainly hope you're both right, because my working assumption through all of this is that what we have with the Putin regime, and I don't say this facetiously, I think this is actually a description of it. It's a crime syndicate masquerading as a state. It happens to be a state that controls 1/6 of the Earth's landmass. But the thing about crime syndicates is they need a legitimate economy to feed off of. And if we deny this crime syndicate access to this legitimate economy, it would wither and die. My worry has always been that we would have, maybe not political will may not be the proper term for it, the will to do so because of this ready-made lobby that they've created. I certainly hope that the two of you are right about that, because I've often thought that the greatest weapon we could use against Russia is simply enforcing our own laws, which the European Union is doing now, vis-a-vis Gazprom with antitrust legislation. I wanted to, along these lines, to broaden this out a little bit, I wanted to cite from an excellent 2012 Chatham House report by James Green. I don't know if you're familiar with this report.
Extremely.
It's a wonderful. I want to quote my favorite passage from it, because you edited it. I think it's a brilliant report. I've cited it numerous times. Putin used the carrot of corruption in conjunction with the stick of kompromat to establish patient-client political relationships inside Russia. By broadening this approach to the corrupt transnational schemes that flowed seamlessly from Russia into the rest of the former Soviet space and oozed beyond it, Putin could extend his shadow influence beyond Russia's borders and develop a natural captured constituency for maintaining a common Eurasian business space. When I read that back when it came out, it got me thinking about where the real lines are here. And we, again, we don't have two blocks facing each other off across the Fulda Gap. What we have, Putin talks a lot about spheres of influence. What he's creating is a sphere of corruption. He wants to expand the corrupt way of doing business as far as he can. He's got fertile ground in the former Soviet space, as James Green argued in that piece very effectively, and he's trying to push it into our space as much as possible. The EU, for all its faults, is creating a zone of transparency. And this zone of transparency is something Russia is also trying to contain. And it's not surprising that the first conflicts, really, the first hot conflicts here happened where? Georgia, Ukraine, and I see one coming potentially in Moldova, right? Why is that the case? Because these are the ones that are on the border of these two zones of transparency and corruption. Go ahead, James.
What we have had, what has emerged, is not a renewal of blocks in the Cold War sense, but two distinct normative systems.
Exactly.
The EU system, the Western system, based on rights, including property rights and sanctity of contract, and rules and laws, and the other system based on patron-client relationships, the merger of money and power, and the subordination of law to the state. That's what we've been looking at. And so the countries that have not have wished to be part of our normative system, but lack either the wherewithal or the commitment to actually do it and bear the costs, are the very countries now that are the most vulnerable in Europe. And that's where we are. And that fluidity, which you describe and James Green describes, is absolutely built into Russia's modus operandi.
But at the same time, we have made inroads into this normative, the Russians' normative system, which I call the sphere of corruption, in Ukraine, in Georgia, in Moldova. They've also made inroads into our system. I mean, if you cite an example from the UK, the From Russia with Cash documentary, which made such a splash there. That's a small example of how they've managed to corrupt our institutions to a degree. So we're each making inroads into each other. No,
politically, it's much more uncomfortable for these interests now in the West to be making this case, and you know that's a big change.
I would double down on that. It's not just, I mean, it's an asymmetric effect. A year ago, I think these concerns would have been validated, but you know, again, the one thing that Putin has succeeded in doing in the West is that it's changed how, you know, all classes of actors view Russia now and view the risks of being associated with Vladimir Putin's regime. So, you know, admittedly in the United States, it's one thing, but even in Europe, the notion is that you don't want to necessarily advertise those kinds of links. And the other thing I would say is that, while I don't deny that you know, there's this sort of two different normative systems in terms of capitalism versus the sort of patron-client relationships that Russia's setting up, you have to, again, observe that the borders of this dispute have moved so far in favor of the Europeans' advantage that, you're right, Russia has managed to attain a few victories in places like Georgia and Ukraine. It's not going to be able to do that in the Baltics. It's not necessarily going to do that beyond, you know, anywhere beyond Moldova and Belarus. There are hard limits on Russia's ability to use its kind of economic relationships to get what it wants. And instead, what it winds up doing is, you know, you wind up with a lot of reports in the West about how, oh, look at Russia's financial influence in the city and look at Russia's supporting of, you know, far right nationalist parties across Europe. This makes for great newspaper copy, and I don't deny that it bears watching, but I also think it's been largely overhyped.
It'll make for better newspaper copy that'll give some people some heart attacks if Le Pen wins the French elections.
Mm. Footnote, I am worried about Latvia because the Russians have much more to play with there, both as far as the diaspora. The so-called Russian compatriots, not the majority of them, but the way parts of it are being mobilized, the links that exist, the Russian foundations operating there, the extraordinary way Russian banks are financing free of charge purchases by Russians of vast swathes of property in the country. Mm-hmm. And still, you know, the weakness of institutions, a large level of corruption, and the fundamental thing, which applies to Baltic states, Ukraine, you can have no hope of dealing with this until you create a well-paid professional civil service law enforcement structures. Because with the current structures, corruption is a necessity of life. Mm-hmm. That's what you've got to make corruption a choice. Once you make it a choice, then it becomes a battle we can start to win.
Mm-hmm. Now, if we look at places like Ukraine and Georgia as the divided Germanies of this, if you want to push this Cold War metaphor, right? I mean, if that is the case, if that is indeed the case, and I do believe that it is, I think we could have a our smartest Russia policy is a good Ukraine policy. Because if we can get Ukraine firmly embedded in the West, securely embedded in the West as a full-fledged Western country, the effect, the catharsis that would spark in Russia, I don't think we can even begin to understand now. And Russia has to have a catharsis if it's ever going to change. So would you see this, our Ukraine and Georgia policy, the both of you, as the key linchpin of containing Russia? Not just because we have to stop them there or they'll go farther in a domino theory sense, but the symbolic value that it would have to move these countries decisively into the West, while at the same time, I don't see a lot of political will to do so.
I think it's a necessary condition. I don't think it's sufficient.
Mm.
And we have to adjust our expectations. You know, it's a double-edged comment that Ukrainians make, that this is the most reformist Ukrainian government since independence. It's a very double-edged comment. Because the people running Ukraine are still part of the culture of power they claim they are trying to change. So they're doing some things very well, particularly things they don't have to do today that are going to have an impact tomorrow. But in terms of the way they operate today, the modus operandi is kinder, more intelligent, but not fundamentally different from what existed before. So this is going to be a very long process. At least in this process, I think we have Ukrainian civil society on our side. And that's a big plus compared to Russia.
That is a big plus, but do you see the support coming from the West for Ukraine that will, I mean, part of it is the Ukrainians themselves, but well, part of it is...
Yeah, I mean, it's in Dan's perspective, but what I worry about is Western patience and what we call Ukraine fatigue. Mm. And patience when it comes to any endeavor that doesn't produce tangible results in timescales that are politically convenient.
No, yeah, Dan, go ahead.
I mean, I first of all, I would say this is much more about Ukraine than Georgia. I don't think Georgia is terribly significant from the point of view of the West in terms of how to deal with Russia. This is all about Ukraine. And the vexing thing about Ukraine, which has been true for the entire post-Cold War era, is that Ukrainian civil society is obviously much stronger than Russian civil society, but the Ukrainian state is far less strong, and far more corrupt if possible.
But also more pluralistic. It's been more pluralistic from the start.
Right. That goes to the civil society point. But in some ways, the most frustrating thing from the point of view of the West is that you would have thought that, you know, the mortal threat of Russia impinging on Ukrainian sovereignty was a true wake-up moment for the Ukrainian political system of, oh, we have to modernize and professionalize, you know, our security apparatus, the way our government runs, and so on and so forth. And, you know, as James said, I think there have been moves in that direction, but probably not nearly as many as the West would have liked to have seen. But that said, I agree with you that in some ways Ukraine is the front lines in terms of how to check Russian power, that the longer and stronger the Ukrainian state gets, manages to maintain, you know, both its independence from Russian influence, the weaker that Russia looks, because there aren't many other fronts where Russia can try to apply the kind of pressure that it's applying in Ukraine. It can try to pressure the Baltics, as you said, but you can argue in some ways that's where NATO has, you know, at least somewhat successfully deterred Russian activity. And as much as Russia tries to occasionally ratchet up its military threats and so forth, that also reveals Russian weaknesses. I mean, I think in the figure I heard was that in the first two weeks where Russia sort of expanded its fighter activity over the Baltics, 5 Russian planes crashed. That wasn't because of U.S. or NATO action. It's because of the problems in terms of the Russian military. So as much as the Russian military,
It's because they're being pushed harder. I read in a recent report that they're being pushed harder now, and it's resulting. Above. Yeah,
right. Exactly. So the point is that, you know, as much as Putin might like the idea of ratcheting up tensions with the West, there are limits on what he can actually do if these tensions continue to further escalate. And you know, we're seeing right now in Syria, and I think we're going to see eventually with Ukraine, the hard limits of this kind of power.
Now, I would agree. I mean, on Ukraine, I've been making the argument that the West needs to turn, for lack of a better term, rump Ukraine, meaning Ukraine minus the occupied territories in Crimea, into West Germany, and turn the, as I put it, the LNR, the DNR into the GDR. Right. Because I think I know which side of that divide any sane human being is going to want to live on. I think that. But I would disagree with you on Georgia, Dan. I think Georgia is quite important. I think it's important for and I'll tell you why. In terms of military reform, no NATO aspirant has done more than Georgia to get up to NATO standards. And Georgia was not given a map in 2008 in Bucharest. If they had been given a map, they would have fulfilled all of the requirements in that map and more. But NATO still has not given them a map. At this point, they are as ready to join NATO as the Czech Republic, Poland, and Hungary were when they joined. But that they are not being allowed to join. Now, I would ask you, what message does that send to the Georgian people who are extremely pro-Western? Anybody that's ever been in, you go to a Georgia as an American, you will never be treated so well any place in the world. It is the most pro-Western country, but that's not going to last forever, because people are beginning to get disillusioned. So I think Georgia is important for, it's not on the front lines to the degree that Ukraine is, but it's an important piece of this puzzle.
I take your point about Georgia. The problem with Georgia is it's where it's located on the map. It was far easier for NATO to absorb the Visegrad states, because those were territorially, without question, uncontestedly part of Europe and bordering other NATO states. Georgia does not have that luxury. You know, and so as a result, you know, to extend NATO to include Georgia, the problem isn't what Georgia has done. The question is whether NATO is prepared to make the Article 5 commitments to Georgia that it's made to these other states. And in some ways, Georgia has the same problem that Ukraine does, which is there's a, you know, we're talking about Georgia, we're talking about Rump Georgia. There are two statelets mm-hmm. that are not part of it. So I think, to be fair, you know, there is a legitimate – I understand your point that you think Europe is too risk-averse with respect to Russia, but there are legitimate grounds for risk aversion in terms of including some of these states that continue to have frozen conflicts with Russian proxies.
Mm-hmm. Brian, I would say first let's think about how to defend Georgia. Then let's think about what mm-hmm. kind of relationship they should have with NATO. And what Ukraine has demonstrated is that with some help from us military and, of course, financial and political, Ukraine to a large degree is capable of defending itself. That's not to say that Russia couldn't destroy the place. The question is what are the costs? Now, just to go back a moment, I think it's very important that everyone understand, you have to remind Western audiences of this, Russia is not fighting a war against Ukrainian corruption. That's not what this is about. Even if Ukraine is not serious about dealing with its underlying problems, it has as much right as the Czech Republic to be an independent and sovereign state. And if that is forgotten, then it has all kinds of implications for others. The moment we say you have to meet Euro-Atlantic standards of governance in order for the basic OSCE obligations to apply to you, then we've had it in Europe. Then the whole security structure unravels. And believe it or not, if you talk to parliamentary audiences and many parts of the Western world, people don't seem to understand that. Mm.
So what from the West side do you do to shore up Ukraine and pull it fully into the West? I mean, NATO membership is not going to happen anytime soon, nor is EU membership. What do you do to embed this frontline state in the zone of transparency in the Western normative system?
Let's be realistic about one thing. First, the funds that Ukraine is getting from the West are stabilization funds, and they're probably adequate for that purpose if Ukraine does half of what it commits itself to do. Ukraine is not getting funds that are adequate to help finance systemic change, let alone a reintegration of the East. And so therefore the current pause is not the worst thing possible, because there is not going to be that money available in the near term. With the refugee crisis going on, with the Greek situation still acting as a drain, with everything else, with Syria, there is not going to be that money. The challenge for us is to avoid the trap that Russia is trying to push us into now, which is to get us to pressure Ukraine to make constitutional changes mm-hmm. that will effectively destroy its sovereignty, give these rump gangsters a veto over the whole system in exchange for an end to fighting. The Russians didn't start fighting in order to have the pleasure of fighting. They wanted a certain political outcome. The danger is we will give them that outcome in order to stop the fighting. That's where
how politics is war by other means, and Putin understands that exactly.
That's exactly what it is. Politics by other means.
Yeah. Well, I was turning Clausewitz on his head, saying politics is war by other means, because that's what I see Russia doing in the diplomatic procedure through.
Well, from
Donetsk.
Perspective, there was no difference.
Yeah. All right, yes. we're bumping up against the clock now. Any last thoughts from either of you before we wrap it up for the week?
I think with everything that is going wrong and could go wrong, the remarkable thing is that we are doing as well as we are, and that, you know, if we do not panic and we maintain our basic sense of direction, I think we will find that the problems for Russia, that Russia is going to be facing, the more serious problems as we look ahead.
So times on the west side then.
Times on the west side if we keep doing what we're doing, but I think we have to do more of it and do it better.
I was literally going to quote Douglas Adams from Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy and say, the principal thing is don't panic. Putin is not nearly as powerful as some of the commentary has made him out to be. That said, you also don't dismiss him. There has to be some – I agree with James completely. There has to be some degree of a sort of resolute behavior to make it clear that as annoying as he is, that there are certain behavior, you know, that you're going to set up for a long-haul occasional conflict with Russia.
Well, leave it to the guy who brought zombies into the realm of international politics to quote The Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy on my podcast. And on that note, we'll wrap it up. That's all we have time for today. I'd like to remind you, you've been listening to the Power Vertical Podcast. My name is Brian Whitmore, author of the Power Vertical blog here at RFURL. Joining me on the Skype line from Oxford, England, has been James Scher, an associate fellow with and former head of Chatham House's Russia and Eurasia program. Also joining us via Skype from Newton, Massachusetts, has been Daniel Dresner, a professor of international politics at the Fletcher School of Law and Diplomacy at Tufts University, a senior fellow at the Brookings Institution, and author of the books Theories of International Politics and Zombies, and the recently published The System Worked, How the World Stopped Another Great Depression. Thank you both for an enlightening discussion.
Thank you.
And I'd also like to thank our brilliant, patient, and ridiculously overworked producer, Tanya Koncheva, and my totally awesome and indispensable colleague, Pavel Butorin, senior producer for RFURL's current time television program, who is now tweeting under the handle at Pasha Butorin. And his feed is just as awesome as ever. I'd also like to remind you, you can subscribe to the Power Vertical podcast on iTunes, you can read the Power Vertical blog at RFURL.org, and you can follow us on the Twitter at Power Vertical. Join us again next week. And now, as always, I leave you with the ambient sounds of my favorite socially conscious Russian rapper, Noise MC.